Thanks. Hi. I actually feel like I know you now. The fourth day. The theme for today is to talk about, it's really the promise was to try to talk about global democracy. What are the possibilities for it? And not in lieu of that, in the interest of approaching that question, I'll mostly be talking about the concept of multitude. And I'll get to talking about that in a minute. Let me give an introduction, though, first. Because it seems to me useful to start when posing questions, or when someone poses the question of what is to be done, as if a philosopher is supposed to answer the question, or even a political leader is supposed to answer the question, what is to be done, I usually find it more useful to not answer that question, but to answer instead what is already being done, or what are people already doing. So I think with that regard, that might be the best place to start in posing the question of global democracy, or democracy on a global scale. And it first seems useful to me in this regard to recognize how so many of the movements, in fact, I would say it's a general characteristic of the movements today, that they are posing the grievances against the lack of democracy on the global scale. Let me give you just a few examples. In fact, this in line with what I was thinking yesterday, I think that often what is expressed as anti-Americanism outside the United States is really a protest not so much against the United States per se, but rather against the anti-democratic behavior of the United States. And so it's often, I think, misunderstood as properly being anti-US when really it's against the obstacles to democracy that the US poses. The second examples are much, much clearer. I think that the general characteristic of the various globalization movements that you could say extended from Genova, start with Seattle to Genova, so from 1999 to 2001 at least. The protests, in other words, against the World Trade Organization, against the G8, against the World Bank and the IMF, and various other institutions, especially throughout North America and Europe, seems to me these were all the common project in all of them were protests or grievances against the lack of democracy, against the undemocratic nature of the World Trade Organization and of the IMF and the World Bank. And of course the G8 too. In fact, let me just give a little parenthesis. I think that if I didn't make clear the notion of empire 2 days ago, it seems to me quite easy to understand it in terms of the activity of the movements themselves. That in fact they were theorizing the same thing that Tony and I were thinking. In other words, If for instance, you thought one were to think that the U.S. was in control of globalization or the global economy, it would only make sense to protest at the White House or maybe on Wall Street. But that's not what the movements were doing. They were protesting, like I say, they were protesting the World Trade Organization and the IMF and the World Bank and the G8 and the free trade arrangement of the Americas and NAFTA, etc. I think that what they were doing is a kind of experimenting with new enemies. Like that each protest was an experiment in trying to understand what the source of global domination is. And if you, in a way, put together the various protests, it was a kind of making evident or a revealing of a network of powers that actually function in common. And that's what the string of protests actually was revealing, something like what we call empire. In other words, this power and network power of various organizations that function together. Just a few more examples, concrete examples, the way that I would try to see the common element in the various protest movements as being oriented at the lack of democracy on the global scale. Let me give three pretty well-known movements. The first is the protest against a large dam in India. It's a dam on the Narmada River. And it's a protest that's been going on for almost 20 years. Protest led by the people who would be displaced by the water of the dam. thousands of people that would be displaced by the water of the dam, and they've been leading a protest against the construction of the dam. And they are protesting against the lack of democracy in their own state, you know, their own region within India. But there, it also is a grievance against the lack of democracy in the Indian state more generally, in the national state. But at the same time, let's say on a third level, it's quite consciously a protest against the workings of the World Bank, because the World Bank not only lends the money for this dam, but it encourages countries in the subordinated parts of the world to construct such dam projects. And so the protest was, I think, at all these levels against the non-democratic nature at the various levels within the world system. Similarly, I mentioned yesterday or the day before the Picatero movement in Argentina. You could also say the assembly, there was a separate movement constructing assemblies in local assemblies in Argentina. This too seems, this is after the economic crisis of 2000. So it lasted from about 2000 to 2003 or 4 in Argentina. Here too, there was a protest against the national government. Their main slogan was que se vayan todos, like that not only one politician leaves, but all politicians leave, which is a nice slogan against the national government. But they were also quite consciously against the IMF and the undemocratic nature of the IMF. See, what I'm trying to do is just give you a number of examples of how the protest movements are really trying to highlight the lack of democracy in the global system, not just within a nation state. The last example, but I won't go into it, I think I've done enough, is about how the Zapatistas in Chiapas in Mexico started not only with a protest against Mexican state and its racism, but against NAFTA. They coordinated the beginning of the protest in January 1st, 1994 with the introduction of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. So it was there too, as a protest against not only national lack of democracy in Mexico, but global or at least international structures that prevent democracy. And once one recognizes, I think what I think of as the generality of the grievance against the lack of democracy on the global scale, it's important to look at then at what the proposals for reforming the global system are to make it more democratic. And I think that in general, and there are numerous proposals, I mean, one might say, and it's often said in newspapers, these people are protesting, why don't they come up with alternatives? And there really is no lack of alternative propositions for changing the global system. And I think, in fact, many of them are good ideas. But in general, the difficulty, it seems to me, and I'll give you some examples of why I might think this, the difficulty is that the proposals to reform the global system to make it more democratic almost always rely on a national analogy of what democracy would mean. In other words, they take what we've understood as national structures for democracy and simply imagine them larger. And there are two ways of thinking this. One is what I would call gigantism, which I'm not sure if it's a word in English, but you know, making everything gigantic. And in fact, this I would categorize under this propositions, or at least imagination of a global state, like a global state which would be the answer to the lack of democracy. This is something, for example, that is part of the imaginary of Ulrich Beck in a book about globalization published maybe 5 or 6 years ago. The notion strictly follows that democracy is only possible within a state, and therefore if there's going to be globalization, there must be a global state for us to have democracy. And so it's just blowing up, I think, the notion of a nation state, first to Europe, a transnational state, and then to the globe as a global state. Another way that this happens, I think, this sort of using the national analogy to try to imagine reforming the global system to make it more democratic. Another way it happens is simply by repeating the institutions that had constituted the nation state and expanding them larger. Like, for instance, I think there's a very interesting and pedagogically useful propositions to create another chamber of the United Nations. As you know, well, in fact, I would think that the General Assembly of the United Nations is perhaps the most democratic of global organs or institutions we have. But it's fundamentally skewed with regard to representation. And in fact, I think the notion of adding another house, which I'm talking about these proposals, you might call it a People's Assembly, some call it, or a global parliament. The imagination is to repeat, for instance, the U.S. government model, repeat it on a global scale. Because you could then think of the existing General Assembly as something like the Senate in the United States, or the upper house. The way the Senate functions in the United States, I'm sure you guys know this about U.S. government, the way the Senate functions is that there are two representatives from each state in the United States, regardless of the size. So the largest state and the smallest state get equal number of representatives in the upper house. And so the idea would be to create a lower house, and that's in a way the way the General Assembly works. China has one representative to the General Assembly, and so does Indonesia, and so does, is Liechtenstein in the United Nations? I don't know. But the smallest of nations, you could imagine, has equal number of representatives. So the idea would be to create a second house that would be proportional, so that, say, China would get 100 representatives and Indonesia 80, and Europe as a whole and the United States maybe 20 each. Now, I like this kind of proposal because it restores at least to the notion of representation the quantitative nature which was essential to the modern notion of representation. In other words, the notion that representatives, that there's, along with the slogan, that one person, one vote. In other words, that there would be a quantitative relationship between the represented and the representatives. But if you think about it very long, it becomes quickly absurd to create a global parliament. In other words, the representation stretched so thin doesn't really mean anything anymore. If you had, for instance, if you were going to have a parliament of, say, 400 representatives on a global scale, you would have something like one representative for every, 100 million people. And that stretched so thin, I'm not sure if I have the number right, stretched so thin, representation means very little. Just to give you a U.S. example, in the drafting of the U.S. Constitution, one of the authors, Madison, said that the ideal ratio is one representative per every 30,000 population. And so now we would have 10 times that. So I guess what I'm trying to point out is the absurdity of taking national institutions and trying to expand them to a global scale. Maybe that's already obvious to you. It's in this regard that I would come back to this analogy which I posed yesterday, I believe. Yes, at the very beginning, which was the way that I think we're in the same situation with respect to democracy that revolutionaries were in the 18th century. Let me repeat it. It just takes me 2 minutes. And it's in this regard that we're in the same situation. In the 18th century, revolutionaries who wanted democracy, I'm thinking of France and the United States principally, but it could be other nations, revolutionaries who wanted democracy were met by skeptics who said, look, in Athens, in a city-state, democracy made sense. But today, in the 18th century, on a national scale, democracy doesn't mean anything. You can't just take the government of a city-state and blow it up into a nation-state. So I think that today we're met by the same skeptics who say, to those of us who want democracy on a global scale, they say, look, democracy meant something in a nation state throughout these 200 or 300 years, but you can't just take the national institutions and blow them up and apply them to the entire globe. And I think the skeptics are right in both cases. What I tried to point out yesterday is that what happened in the 18th century revolutions, or at least what the 18th century Democrats, what the revolutionaries wanted, was not to simply repeat Athens on a larger scale, but rather to create new institutions and even invent a new concept of democracy that would be adequate for the modern age and for the national space. And so that in the same way today, it seems to me, and this is my criticism of the kind of reform proposals I just pointed towards, it seems to me that today, too, we can't simply repeat the modern notion of democracy, and we can't just repeat its institutions. We have to both invent a new concept of democracy and invent new institutions that would be adequate to a global rather than a national scale. What I like so much about the analogy is to recognize how it can be done. The fact that it was possible in the 18th century, however imperfectly, points at least to the fact that it's something that could be accomplished today. So with that goal in mind, it's in that context that I, or Tony, my co-author, and I would like to propose Multitude as a concept for helping to reconceive democracy. Helping to reconceive democracy not only for the global scale, because scale is not the only question, but for the contemporary world. That's a different way of putting it. And so I have a formula for it, of course, because as you know, I like formulas. If I talk here, it seems to reverberate. So I think this is my formula. Remember, almost all of you were here yesterday, and I tried formulas. And so I mean it in the spirit of Lenin's or the Soviets' notion that communism equals Soviets plus electrification. And then I tried with Jefferson having a different formula. And so this is my formula for the day, which I'll try to explain. That's my point, to explain it. And I'll explain it from three perspectives. My usual style of organization. And that's all I'm going to talk about, really, just these three perspectives of approaching the concept of multitude. First, an economic perspective, a philosophical perspective, and finally, a political perspective. After which, I'll talk briefly about love, because the stuff about multitude won't be satisfying enough. So here we go, the economic perspective. This is returning to the first, referring to the second day, to 2 days ago, in which I was trying to explain what I understand as biopolitical production and how that biopolitical production today exerts an hegemony over other forms of production. And what I meant by exerts an hegemony over is that just in the same way that industrial production for the last 200 years has imposed its qualities over other kinds of production, just as agriculture and mining and society itself have had to industrialize, had to become like industry. Today, the argument goes that the qualities of immaterial production or biopolitical production, that is, the focus on information, on communication, on affects, on images, all of these qualities are going to be progressively imposed on other forms of labor and production, so that industry will have to informationalize and become image-oriented and become affective and et cetera. Now, in the context for today, or approaching the concept of multitude, if that's not already evident to you in that notion, I guess an economic notion of the multitude depends, first of all, on the generalization of the capacities of biopolitical labor. The generalization throughout the global population of these talents and capacities for producing communication and producing information, producing affects. In fact, that's what I was trying to emphasize the other day, is that the ultimate way of thinking of this is the production of social relationships. If the ability to produce social relationships seems to me the essence of this biopolitical production in its various ways, either via images, via affects, via intelligence, etc. So the claim is that all of global labor is becoming biopolitical. It's a tall claim. I mean, it's not an easy one to verify, but let me give you a couple ideas of why it might be true. Because let's see. The first thing I think one should think when I say something like that is, okay, I'll accept that in the internet capitals of the world. I mean, I'll accept that for Seattle and Munich and then maybe even Hyderabad or something like that. But it doesn't immediately seem to be sensible to give it to the entire global population. Like, even to agriculturalists, that would be another way of saying it, those who continue to work in the fields. In what sense is their labor becoming biopolitical in this sense? Let me just give you a couple ideas of how it might seem plausible. I don't pretend to want to convince you, because I haven't quite even convinced myself. But one approach could be to look at, for agriculturalists, the question of seeds. You know, I've been thinking mostly about agriculture in this regard. I don't know if that makes sense to you immediately. It seems to me like the most distant case and the one would have to verify most. And that's why it seems to me worth focusing on. You know, it seems to me the one that's traditionally thought of as most either backward or left out of economic advance, and that's why it seems to me worth thinking of. Like, if I could convince you that people working in the fields in China had these necessary capacities, I think I would have a lot better chance of convincing you than if I told you that someone working at Microsoft had them. So that's why I'm doing it. So here's the first one is thinking about seeds. Because the question of the ownership of seeds has become increasingly important. Many of you might already know about this, but if you haven't heard these sorts of things, it's been in the last 10 and 20 years that as seed companies, Monsanto is the most famous one of these, as they develop ever new seeds and have patents on the seeds, it both controls the agriculture of people because they have to buy these seeds rather than producing them themselves, but it also takes out of the hands of agriculturalists the kinds of seed development they've always done. Farmers have always selected seeds for larger fruit or better resistance to pests or something like that. And so what has been happening is that their seeds have become increasingly private property, and it's taken the creativity out of people's hands. Now, this is, as you can imagine, it's very important in agriculture. I guess I should give you the extreme case of it that's often referred to with people who occupy themselves with this. They're called killer seeds, which sounds very dramatic. It's a something that the seed companies develop. They're seeds that don't reproduce, so that they would grow a plant this year, but that plant won't produce seeds for the next year. So that therefore the agriculturalists have to every year buy from the seed company rather than saving seeds themselves. Now, this, it seems to me, is directly a question of information. And it seems useful to recognize how, you know, first of all, it's a question of information in the way the patents work. I assume the word in German is recognizable for patents, or close to it. The way the patents work is that what is produced, and therefore what's given the right of property, is the genetic information in the seed. It's called the germplasm. So it's directly an information question. But you might think of it as an information question also from the perspective of the farmer or the agriculturalist, because they too, even though not or working with a different kind of science, you might say, have always operated on basis of information. Like, it's not like farmers are stupid. They just have a different way of developing the same kinds of scientific programs that the scientists do. And so what I'm trying to point out is that this question of information in seeds is becoming increasingly important, and that might be one way of understanding how, like the Microsoft engineers, the farmers too are having to pay ever-increasing attention to information as part of the production process. In a more generalized way, you might think of as biopolitical labor the kind of survival of the poor, or even survival strategies of the poor. Think of the urban poor or also the rural poor. The kinds of survival of the unemployed and destitute, I mean, could be in the dominant countries, but even more so in the subordinate countries. The kind of survival strategy they do is incredible amount of talent and ingenuity. This, what would you say, reproduction of life against all odds that you can think of as techniques of survival is itself a kind of immaterial labor. Or at least, and this is the important part, at least it demonstrates the talents and capacities that I was trying to describe as part of biopolitical production. Let me just give a little communist socialist history example to make it clear why I care so much about this. Central, it seems to me, to the history of socialist and communist political movements for the last 200 years has been the division among different forms of labor for their political capacity. And specifically, for quite a long stretch of our history in the 19th and 20th centuries, it was assumed that peasants could not act politically, that peasants had to follow the industrial working class. The rhetoric can sound familiar to you, that the proletariat is the natural leader of the peasantry. Now, there were reasons for this. You can think, for example, of Marx's writing in the 18th Brumaire. So in the 18th Brumaire, Marx is talking about the French peasantry in 1848, 1851, right in the middle of the 19th century. And he says, quite famously then, that the peasants cannot represent themselves. They must be represented. What he means by that is that the peasantry, since they are dispersed on the countryside, and precisely because they can't communicate with each other, they can't act politically as a class. Whereas the urban industrial proletariat, because in its work, in its very work, it communicates internally, can act as a class. In other words, that this ability to communicate, even to communicate collectively, is what allows for the possibility of political action. I think this is long assumed, and whether it was true or not in the middle of the 19th century, I'm willing to leave open question. But my claim would be, and this is why I want to argue about these capacities that even agriculturalists have today, is that even if that were true before, that it's not true today. I guess I would want to argue that all of us are able to have these political capacities and even have them in our labor or our life activity. So that's why I want to insist that these abilities of biopolitical production, of producing communication and affects and images and information, etc., that I want to argue about its generality, because that generality for me guarantees the possibility that all of us equally can act politically. I hope that makes sense. Okay. Second economic approach to the same question, but more from a, what would you say, philosophical perspective. But still, I'm on the economic part. This is still part A of economic approach to the multitude. And it has to do with the poor, or the concept of the poor. Your first introduction, think of Francis of Assisi. Like, there are two aspects of Francis that interest me, and I hope sound familiar to you. The first is the proposition of equality in the poor. You know, so if it sounds, I assume that at least you would have the recognition of a kind of slogan of a certain Christianity about preferential treatment to the poor, or preferential option for the poor. So in Francis, which seems to be at least one center of this, the first claim in this notion of the poor is about equality. And it's, for Francis, it's not just equality among humans, it's equality with all the world. You know, when Francis talks about brother sun and sister moon, and then he talks to the birds and he preaches to the wolves, it's all about a kind of universal equality. So not only equality among humans, but equality with the world itself. The second, though, is that what's intended is a kind of inversion of the traditional notion of wealth. Like, it's not an option for poverty, meaning we should fail to enjoy the things that are wonderful. It's rather saying that the kind of thing that you assumed was wealth is really not wealth. It's really the poor that are wealthy. This would be the kind of inversion that I think. So I think that that's the two things that I'm interested in Francis of Assisi are those two, the equality and the inversion of the notion of wealth and poverty. So to go along with that, I mean, to try to extend it, it seems to me that I would argue that the poor today, let's say the unwaged, but also those excluded, you know, excluded from production, excluded from consumption, that they are really socially productive. Let me give some examples. So it's not that they're useless. That in fact they're quite productive socially, it's just they're not being paid for it. Let me give you two examples. One traditional example from feminist arguments is how women's domestic labor, although unpaid, is of course socially necessarily and socially productive. Maybe that's an obvious one. So in that regard, that's the first approach to it. Another one, which is also sort of a conventional one, but seems useful in this regard to me, is to think of how, especially in the United States, I bet you'd have good examples in Germany too, in the United States, how African-American youth are in fact the ones who are most linguistically and culturally creative. Like that a lot of U.S. culture and a lot of U.S. linguistic invention comes from one of the most subordinated parts of the population. So that there's a kind of social productivity in their activities, and one that's in fact not, the fact of it not being waged doesn't mean that it's in fact not socially profitable. It means usually that someone else is making the profits. But so the argument here is that in the general way is that all are productive in this social network, and one might argue that all should therefore be compensated. But my main point was rather that, like I was trying to describe the other day, 2 days ago about this, that it's not that in biopolitical production there really isn't the possibility of individual production, that all production is necessarily collective in networks. And that this, my claim here is that the poor, conceiving the poor is a way of grasping the generality and collective nature of this social productivity. The way of grasping a power, in other words, the concept of the poor isn't oriented towards charity. It isn't oriented towards recognizing victimization. At least as I'm using it, the concept of the poor is oriented towards recognizing the generality of that productive, generality and collective nature of that productive power. I thought of that thing of the poor as a repeat of the more economic argument I was trying to make about the generality of the productive capacities of biopolitical production. Okay, I'll move on. Luckily for you, these three approaches to the multitude are separate enough so that if you don't get one, just let it go, and the next one, you can pick up on that. So here's the philosophical one. And again, I've divided into two unequal parts. The major part has to do with the history of 17th century English political thought. Because you could derive the concept of the multitude from Spinoza, which is a good source, but before Spinoza, multitude was used in 17th century England as a technical political term. And I'll explain what it means in a minute. It's a big problem in German and in many other languages. I have no idea how to translate multitude. As you'll see in a minute, in our book Empire, it was translated as Menge, which is not good. But I don't know a good solution. So in English too, it's not the kind of word that people use all the time now. It sounds good in English, actually, only because it's used in the King James Bible, the sort of standard edition like the Luther Bible, and that's because that was done in the 17th century. Okay, so let me give you the 17th century history to let you know to try to explain what the philosophical content of the concept is. Political philosophy, obviously. It's also tricky in the 17th century because most of the authors we have are against the multitude. So we get a distorted notion of it. It's one of those interesting historical concepts that you have to read only in its negative. But it's interesting that way. So the first example is Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, who makes the contrast between the people and the multitude. And he says this, that the people, since it is one, since it is unified, the people can be sovereign. Whereas the multitude, he says, since it's not one, since the multitude is a multiplicity, it can't rule. The multitude for him is anarchy, because it's ununified. Whereas the people for him, and this is an interesting notion, that the people is always one. The people is, of course there are many different people in, like, the English people, but the people as a concept functions as a representation, as a unified representation. So that's the first distinction, then, that's helpful, I think. It's the multitude is different from the people. Let me give you, then, the positive expression of the multitude. And I think that multitude takes on this technical political meaning on one day, like it started on one day, which I love this sort of thing. Foucault loves this sort of thing too. It started on one day in the winter of 1642. So in 1642 is in the early period of the English Civil War. And in the English Civil War, the parliamentary forces are fighting against the royal forces. And early in the war, the royal forces are winning. And the radicals, you know, who were not part of the parliament, who were against the king, they're worried that the parliament is going to make a deal, you know, to end the war with the king. And so in their discussions, they say, what do we do if the parliament makes peace with the king? And their answer is that at that point, the power that is vested in the people is restored to the multitude. What they mean is that the people is the English population that can vote. It's the ones with property that elect parliament. Whereas the multitude for them is the entire population. In other words, dependents, all the people without property. It'd be very unclear. I would be interested, but I have no way of figuring this out, whether women would be included in their concept of the multitude. But in any case, it's something like a concept of the poor. I think you understand it. You can understand again what it would mean here, the difference between the people and the multitude. The multitude, yeah, you'd think of as everyone, whereas the people is just the ones who have property and can vote for parliament. So it's in this way, I guess I would try to define the multitude. I'd have to do a little bit more work to justify this in this instance as the multitude is the right of resistance incarnate. Like it's the subject of the right of resistance. Or another way of saying the same thing, referring now again to something I was talking about yesterday, is that in the multitude, its resistance is prior to power. Like the multitude is able to either claim power for itself or govern itself. So this is the Civil War example. Let me give you a third example, which I know I'm working with things here that you don't know. Every English schoolchild knows this book by Spencer called The Faery Queen. It's like written in 1600 and it's required school reading for all children. And it's another negative example of the use of the multitude, but I find it interesting for my purposes, so let me explain. It's incredibly boring, so don't worry. It's a long analogy about knights and what should I say? I have no idea in German what it would be comparable to. But it's something, it's like chivalrous literature, and it's all analogies to philosophical concepts, if that makes sense. So it's right just after Shakespeare, really, so right in that period. So there's one part in it with a knight. It's the chapter on justice, and there's a knight. His name is Artegal, but you don't have to care about that. This knight comes to a town, and in that town, it's dominated by a giant, and the giant is advocating equality, but he's advocating equality not only for the people, or creating equality, not only for the entire population, but he's also equalizing all of nature. Like he's making all of the mountains flat, and he's making everything equal in the world. So our knight, the hero, says that this equality is unjust because this equality denies differences and differences that are given by God. So that you can imagine, you know, equating equality in the population with the equality, you know, like lowering all the mountains and raising all the valleys, etc., is what. And so the knight attacks the giant and kills the giant, and the multitude, he says, rises up against the knight, but the knight defeats the multitude. It's interesting to me that the multitude then comes. Spencer will call them the multitude and not the people, for instance, when they are rising up in the name of equality. That's what. And so you could see another definition of the concept then. Multitude equals resistance in the name of equality. But it seems to me, and this is why I find the example interesting, is that Spencer's confusing equality and sameness. Like that he's understanding equality as if equality could only mean sameness. And instead, the multitude is rather equal, but composed of singularities. And that's what I want to, I guess, explain in a minute, what singularity would mean. Because I think that singularity and equality don't contradict, whereas difference and sameness do. So let me just take a break. And so what does all this mean, the history of 17th century English thought? And so, in fact, if one of you were to imagine in the course of this what a German word for multitude would be, please tell me, like, if you can think of one. So what it means so far is that it's not the people on the one hand, so that, in fact, I should do this. Here's how to situate the concept. I need to do this with a mind map. So the multitude is not the people, because the people is unified, and the multitude is a multiplicity. That makes sense. On the other hand, the multitude is not a series of other social multiplicities. It's not the crowd, the masses, or the mob. I know that some of those have direct German, like Menge. This is where I would put Menge, actually, but maybe I'm wrong about that. And the reason it's different, the multitude is different from the crowd or the masses or the mob, but for two reasons that quickly become the same. On the one hand, the crowd or the masses or the mob seem to be composed of differences, but they quickly fade into gray. You know, the masses is quickly, it's not different, it's indifferent. You know, that the people who compose the mass are quickly become, that's what I mean, it fades into gray, and become indifferent. Rather than remaining different, it's internal components. The second thing, which I think is really implied in the first notion, is that these other social subjects, the mob, the masses, the crowd, are fundamentally passive. Like, they can't act on their own. They're often manipulated. You know, the masses or the mob can do things. They can sometimes do horrible things. But they can't lead themselves. They have to be led. That's why, of course, you know, the notion of the crowd functions so closely with the notion of panic, because of this kind of imitation and following. You know, panic comes from the god Pan, you know, the piper that leads. Okay. And so that's what's different about the multitude, is the multitude, the claim is that it's an active social subject, active meaning that it can lead itself and doesn't require or even doesn't allow for manipulation or leadership. And that's related to, I'm claiming, that internal differentiation, the multiplicity of it. So that's one thing. Okay, the concept's different from the people, and it's different from the masses and the mob, etc. The other thing is that it's... the multitude is defined by singularity and equality. I'm going to talk about this a little bit more. In fact, here's just another philosophical, maybe call it an aside rather, to try to understand the term singularity. Because in English, and I bet in German too, singularity doesn't make much sense immediately, whereas in French it does. And so I want to explain why it makes sense in French. Because it's been a continuous concept in French philosophy for a long time. And specifically, or this is the way I think of it, and I think I'm right, it has to do with angels. Because in the 12th century, you know, in 1100, etc., there was new theories of angels, and it actually was specifically a lot of it in Paris, angelology. Which is, I wish I could be an angelologist. Seems like a great title. And what's most remarkable, really, is that in 1277, in 1277, the Bishop of Paris outlawed the teaching of angels, which is pretty extreme. And what he was afraid of are two separate things, but they come quickly the same. The theories of angels in the 12th century, in the 11th century too, they were part of an effort to combine Greek and Arab thought with Christianity. It was mostly a way of translating Aristotelianism, the way Aristotle entered. And so in part you might think the Bishop of Paris is upset about this corruption of Christianity with Greek and Arab thought. But more importantly, from a theological perspective, he's upset because angels are separate substances. Angels are singularities. And this is the continuity of the term, because singularity is then developed along with these theories of individuation. A dunce goddess is one, for instance, in this period. And so angels are singularities, and they're dangerous from a theological perspective because they threaten the unity of God. If angels are separate substances from God, they threaten the idea that all is God, because angels are separate substances. They're incorporeal substances, but nonetheless separate essences. So in any case, this is why I think that, what does the angel thing do for me so far? It's really that the thinking of singularity always depends on multiplicity. That's what I wanted to get from this. That when you say singularity, it doesn't mean unity. On the contrary, every singularity is first a multiplicity. So it's not only that singularity and multiplicity aren't contradictory. Singularity has a necessary relationship to multiplicity. That's I don't know if that makes sense to you with angels. Maybe some of you, I'm a big angel fan, that they seem interesting to me. But if you don't, it doesn't matter. It's just that what I want about it is this relationship that something can be singular, you know, a singularity, and be multiple. It can both internally be multiple, and that singularities can define a multiplicity. Let me try to give the, now I'll go on to the political approach, and that if all that sounded too abstract, this at least makes it more concrete. So remember, I first tried the economic approach, then the philosophical approach, and now it's the political one. A good way, it seems to me, to start with this, to try to get an idea what I mean by singularity and equality, not contradicting, are two 70s slogans in the U.S., which, yeah, even if they don't have correlates, you'll understand them. They're exactly the same. There was a feminist slogan in the U.S. in the 70s that said, "We don't want a world without gender. We want a world in which gender doesn't matter." And exactly the same one in anti-racist struggles. "We don't want a world without race. We want a world in which race doesn't matter." And what they mean by doesn't matter means that it doesn't define hierarchy. And this is what I'm trying to call actually singularity and equality at the same time. Like, we don't want a world in which we are no longer black. We want a world in which being black doesn't mean that we're subordinated. That makes perfect sense, right? But it's trying to say we don't want to destroy our singularity. We want to destroy our inequality. And the same thing with gender inequality. I think that's a pretty good example of this notion about singularity and equality not conflicting. Here's another approach to the same question with a kind of very quick and reduced history of the movements in the U.S. By movements, I mean, you know, the extreme left. And I think it's the same in Europe, but I'll say it in the U.S. terms and you can tell me if it's the same. Or you can tell me I've got it wrong in the U.S., which might be true, too. I think that my generation, you know, let's even say the one before me, the 60s, which is before me, inherited two models of organization. No, let's say me. Let's say the 80s. We inherited two models of organization, one of them based on identity and one of them based on difference. There was the one based on identity was essentially the party form. It doesn't always have to be parties, but it's one where, of course, we can have different people and different agendas, but really, for the political struggle, we need to be unified. And we're unified under one leadership and under one unified agenda. In other words, yes, of course, women can be part of the struggle, but they have to defer their agenda for the major agenda of the workers' movement, etc. You see what I mean by the unity model? Yeah, think of it as the party. And so, in large part, in reaction to this, grew in the U.S., first anti-racist movements, but then the feminist struggles, gay and lesbian struggles, numerous others, saying, forget it, we're not going to be part of your agenda, we're not going to follow your leadership, we're going to have our own struggle with our own agenda, our own organization, etc. And based on differences, we will organize separately. So I think that we inherited those two models of organization that were based on the, sort of in more philosophical terms, on the contradiction between identity and difference. the irreconcilability between identity and difference, if you know what I mean. So then in the U.S., of course this happened elsewhere and earlier, but in the U.S. there was a recognition with Seattle, with the WTO protests in 1999, that this was different. And this is what people had so much trouble understanding about Seattle, because in the Seattle protests there were a lot of groups involved, and many of them were assumed to have been not only antagonistic to each other, but actually completely opposed. For instance, environmentalists and trade unions, or gays and lesbians and church groups, or anarchists and people against the prison industrial complex, or groups against racism, etc. All of these groups were there in Seattle, and there was no unified leadership. And this would pose a problem, because in the old way of thinking didn't make any sense. And I think that what we've seen since then, and you know, in Seattle it was learned from Chappas already, and it was learned from elsewhere already, but what we've seen since then is a new mode of organizing which isn't based on identity or difference. In fact, it's not based on the contradictory couple, identity and difference, but rather on singularity and cooperation. In other words, that's what was going on in Seattle, and that's what's been going on in every summit protest since then, which is that various groups will maintain their autonomy. See, that would be the other way you could do it. If you didn't want to be so philosophical, you could call this autonomy and cooperation. That would be, it has more of a political history to it, maybe. We'll maintain our autonomy, and yet we'll cooperate together, and that this has become, it seems to me, the dominant model of organizing now, which it's, I think, has replaced the contrasting paradigm of identity and difference as models. I've got a little more to say about that, I suppose. It seems to me, I should say two other things. Another way you'd approach this, you could talk about the social forums, the World Social Forum, the European Social Forums, the various regional social forums, which I think, too, are trying to experiment with this kind of logic of autonomy and cooperation. They might not always put it in those terms, but I think that's more or less what the form of the social forums are, the form they're aiming towards. Now, all I've given so far are a couple, like, small groups that are even in the dominant parts of the world. You know, I could then give you examples about Zapatismo and something else, but you've probably heard this, they become cliche after a while, all of the little examples. They're only examples in a way of trying to help think what possibility is. It's certainly true that the people who will protest at Seattle or Genoa are not going to become and shouldn't become some sort of vanguard that's going to lead the world. Rather, I think they can suggest kinds of experiments that others working in parallel could develop, rather than assuming that this is, when I point to these examples, in other words, it's not meant to mean that they are prefiguring our future, but rather to point to some experiments that try to deal with this. And I would say that any possible project for democracy, but then, see, that's when I get to my most arrogant kinds of formulations, would have to struggle with these questions about the maintenance of singularity and the kinds of collaboration or cooperation that are necessary for a democracy. I think that's, in fact, I'd be tempted to say, but then I feel like I'm just too much inside my own concept, that at least the qualities that we're trying, with which we're trying to define this concept multitude, are necessary ones for democracy itself. You can't think democracy without coming to terms with, if not the concept of multitude, at least what it's trying to grasp. It's at this point that someone should ask me, or at least I should ask myself, but there are questions I can't answer, rest assured. What will the institutions of such a global democracy be? And how, in fact, will we bring it about? It's probably fortunate I don't have any answers for these. I have a little answer for this institutional question. You know, like when I was before criticizing, I don't know, you know, the United Nations or notions of a global state. Like, if I'm not just a whiner, you know, if I'm not just complaining, what is it I have to propose instead? And I don't really have anything to propose. The one little idea that I think is already implicit in many of the things I've said is that the network logic of biopolitical production, the decentered and autonomous creation of cooperation and collaboration, etc., that's already implicit in biopolitical production, that might itself suggest a logic, and even an institutional logic, that could then be experimented as part of a governing structure. But in a more general way, I think it's important to say that these aren't the kind of questions that anyone is going to answer, and certainly not a lone philosopher. In fact, mistrust anyone who says he or she has answers to these questions. It seems to me that they're the kinds of questions that can only be answered collectively in movements, that can be answered politically. What seems to me the limit of what I could do, or maybe even we as a group here could do, is to pose these questions and point toward ways in which people are already experimenting with them, rather than pretend to be able to answer them. Okay, the last little bit just about love. When someone, especially someone who at least pretends to be interested in politics as much as I do, and when they end with something abstract like this, you know that they're trying to cover over not being able to have the answers. But that's okay. That's sort of, I just wanted to, pose the self-revelation. What this is idea about love as a political concept that Tony, my co-author, and I have been struggling with for a while. It's one of those ideas that we've been saying we need to understand and haven't yet been able to. But let me give you as far as we've gotten so far and see what it sounds like to you. It seems to me that, first of all, that love was a political concept, was a pre-modern political concept, and that in much of Christianity and Judaism, and probably in Islam, but I don't know anything about it, that love did function as a political concept. I'm thinking, for instance, of Paul's letters and the way the project of the construction of the community is posed as a project of love. What I think has happened is that love has become trapped in the couple and that we have to free it from the couple. Let me try to explain how I think it got destroyed, and that might then suggest what could come next. I think that love as a political concept was destroyed by a double operation. I think of it as being conducted by romanticism and by pornography, although that's not quite the right word. But first, romanticism. And this is the notion of, you see, both of these two operations, in addition to what I'm going to say about them, also confine love to the couple. I don't want to say the bourgeois couple, that's sort of like the old term for it. It just sounds a little too corny. But what I mean is the familial relationship. That's the better way of saying it. Because now it is accepted that you can love not only your husband and wife, but also you can love your children and parents. But love has been isolated in the family. That's a better way of saying it. Okay. One way that's done is by romanticism, is by conceiving love as emerging in unity. Like, this is why I was trying to figure out today about Goethe's ginkgo leaf. Because we're so oppressed by it here in Weimar. I don't know if you feel that way, but this ginkgo is everywhere. And it's exactly that. It seems like center of the romantic operation with regard to love, which is conceiving love as the two that become one. I find that revolting, personally. Like, even in thinking my own romantic life, the revolting of merging in unity. What it seems to me that it denies is the possibility of singularity. Like, that singularity and multiplicity itself are denied in that merging into unity. That they're no longer two. This is why, who was I talking with this about yesterday? I said at a certain point how I found myself being anti-dialectical, like against dialectics. It's specifically this about dialectics. This is, of course, probably something that Goethe and the Romantics share with Hegel, which is that that specific notion of dialectics, which poses differences as contradictions, and contradictions that then can be subsumed in a unity, that this notion of difference is denies singularity and denies multiplicity, because every difference can be pushed to the extreme of contradiction, and that contradiction subsumed within a unity. It's that dialectics that I'm against, and it seems to me that that's what Goethe's little ginkgo leaf is doing. Okay, that's the one thing, the romanticism side. The pornography side, I'm thinking specifically of Georges Bataille and Bataille's book on eroticism, which is actually quite a beautiful book, but in which he poses Eros as the continuity of life, which then leads to a kind of combination of mysticism and eroticism and pornography. That's where it's on the link between those two, that Eros is the continuity of life against death. I don't know if that immediately makes sense to you, but what it seems to me to do, this is at least one of the problems, is that it reduces love to Eros and strips love of its other faces. Yeah, let me just describe this one with a third example, which I think brings these two together, and I'm thinking about more recent or contemporary Christian theology. I'm thinking about Paul Tillich, if he's familiar to any of you, but it doesn't matter if he isn't. A Christian theology that I think does these two operations together. It both poses the love of God as the merging within a unity, like that love, and particularly the love of God, but any other love too, is that merging within a unity, and also their very insistence on the separation among the three notions of love, Eros, Philia, and Agape, which they want to, of course, exclude Eros, and then divide up Philia and Agape. And it seems to me that that's what, there are two things that one has to do then to counter this operation, which is to insist on singularity and multiplicity, and therefore struggle against the notion of love as emerging in unity. And the second is to maintain the relationship among Eros, Philia, and Agape. Could I give, so that Eros is primarily, someone help me if I do this not quite right, Eros is primarily the physical notion of love related to sexuality, Philia with friendship, and Agape with the notion of the community. So the Christian theology is often puts the accent on Agape. And I want to say that the three shouldn't be separated. That's what I'm... And that in a way, Bataille separates in one direction and the Christians do in another. The other thing to go into here, but I'll leave this out. And some of you might know better than me. Psychoanalysis is right in the middle of this whole thing. I mean, even Lacan's Seminar 11 and stuff, psychoanalysis too can't think love outside of the couple. That would be my anti-psychoanalytic part. So how better to think love? Well, my recourse whenever I'm in trouble is to think about Spinoza. And Spinoza's definition of love has a double, two elements in it. Spinoza recognizes love as, on the one hand, the increase of our power, and on the second, the recognition of an external cause. That might not sound very romantic to you, but it's his kind of definition. And what I'm interested in about it, when I'm in love, or when I feel love, or what love is, that's a better way of saying it, because in love already says something else. Love is my recognition of my increase in power and my recognition of the external cause of that increase of my power. I think that makes sense. What interests me is that there's no merging involved here, that we remain singular. In fact, the externality of the cause is necessary in the concept itself. There's no merging in love, therefore, but rather the relationship that involves the increase of power. So that I think that's a way of being able to understand or think about love as singularity plus cooperation, or singularity plus the creation of some sort of relationship. And so Spinoza might help me think the project of love as the project of the multitude. That's where I was going with that. One last thing, and then I am going to stop for the final time. When I talk about love this way, and like when I do it in universities, I always get a kind of, you know, rolling of the eyes. It's sentimental. I don't know if they think I'm, I don't know, Mediterranean or something. You know, something where, you know, and so if Tony were doing it here, you would say, oh, he's Italian, and just leave it at that. On the other hand, yeah, it's this kind of either sentimentality or I'm not sure what, or someone will think I'm religious, because the two places that people quickly understand are, one, the theologians. When I talk to theological seminaries, they love that I talk about love. I mean, they're all over that. But the other is in the movements. You know, that political militants seem to me, especially of a certain generation, the younger generation of political militants today, they already think of what they're doing as love. Like, they're already thinking about the movements as love. And in fact, it makes perfect sense to me that, it sounds just like anecdote, but you might have had the same experience. When you're in part of a great political action, there is this feeling of love. And it's a kind of love where there isn't really a difference between agape and philia and eros. There's a kind of, what I mean to say is it's not just an erotic feeling in the movement, you know, in the action, but it's not excluded from that either. It's something where you recognize the community that you're constructing, and it is all based on friendship, and there is more than that. There's not excluded from the erotic. And I think this is something, just the final thing I want to say, that it seems interesting to me how in different concepts, the concept seems to make more and less sense. I feel the need, even though I didn't make any notes for this, I feel the need to say like just one or two things, just to write, especially because I'm so grateful that so many of you were here for like so many of the days. But I don't really know what to say. I mean, I think if the way I see this, you know, panorama of things that have moved from the trying to define the concept of empire and the current form of domination to thinking both about the potential in labor today and the possibilities of democracy yesterday and today, I see it all as just an unresolved project. And maybe better for that, like that I don't expect a kind of resolution. I sort of hope you don't expect a resolution at the end of the days. But rather that the proposing these questions, maybe that's the best that one can do and the only thing one should do. I'm going to stop there before I get into more, but I'm hoping that you'll say something, actually. Yeah, thanks very much. That's the end of it.